Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall. An evening investigating an alleged haunted road led Trey Hudson and his team to stumble across something far more mysterious. What they discovered was a location they dubbed The Meadow. An area of the highest strangeness that has enabled the team to capture some incredible footage over the last decade as part of their ongoing Meadow project. But before Trey joins me to tell us all about The Meadow, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes. And thank you to each and every one of you for your regular contributions. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for updates and episodes. Our exclusive merchandise site is available through TeePublic, and you'll find the link for that in the show notes as well. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Mr. Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. The Meadow now awaits us, in the company of the marvellous Trey Hudson. Areas of high strangeness have always intrigued people throughout time. These places seem to be a magnet for all manner of the weird. With a lifelong interest in the unusual, Trey Hudson found himself, with his team, uncovering an area that seems to tick all of those boxes. The Meadow Project is an ongoing investigation that continues to reveal its secrets to those with the patience to persevere. And as Trey says in one of his books, you have to follow the folklore. Trey, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me, Paul. I mean, I'm just really happy to be here. I'm glad that our schedules are able to finally mesh up and, you know, doggone it, we're making it happen. So it doesn't get any better than this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As I say to anybody involved in the investigation of high strangeness areas, Trey, I will fit in wherever I can. I appreciate it. I am not a very interesting diversion from these incredible things that you guys have been uncovering over there. And as I said to you prior to this, for me, I've kind of got to see and hear about you and your team's work kind of in parallel with what our friend Paul Sinclair has been doing over in Bempton and had the opportunity to visit Paul and spend some time out there with him. I'm fascinated essentially by your journey to this point that you found yourself in over the last sort of 10 or 15 years, Trey, because one of the things that struck me when I first came across your work is obviously your education. You had the honour of learning under the legendary William Rolle.
Oh, yes.
And like you said in numerous things, you started off as a ghost guy. I mean, I think most of us do, I think, sometimes, Trey, especially of a certain vintage like we are, that essentially it's either UFOs or ghosts that pull you in. And then as we start to uncover things and look at things, it depends if you're open-minded enough to get outside of that normal box that these kind of tranches of the strangeness find themselves in, Trey. And you seem to be one of those who's just punched through it and gone, hey, I used to be a ghost guy and now I'm into everything.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of, you know, as when I was growing up, you know, as a young child of the 70s, you had the trifecta of high strangeness. You had UFOs, you had ghosts, and you had Bigfoot or Sasquatch. Those were the three. And anybody doing research, you know, at that time was firmly ensconced into one of those three genres. And heaven forbid if you should ever wander over into the other one, because you would be, you know, really ridiculed. And, you know, I kind of got a little bit of a taste of that back in the early, about 2012. I was invited to a Bigfoot conference by a friend of mine who was speaking. And I had on a t-shirt that said, you know, said something paranormal, you know, so it kind of identified me as a ghost guy. But, you know, I've always tried to be, you know, open-minded. And, you know, all these, you know, Bigfoot guys kept looking at me kind of with, you know, I don't know if you have the term over there across the pond, but gave me the stink eye. You know, they were kind of you know, giving me the stop eye. You know, wondering what's this ghost guy doing here? But the odd thing is during the breaks, I would have many of these fellows come over to me and say, hey, I don't want anyone to see me talking to you, but I had this happen. You know, I had orbs. I had disembodied voices. I had apparitions. What do you think is going on? And I had to, you know, take a deep breath and step back because, like you said, I was a ghost guy and start looking at this from a more holistic perspective. You know, maybe all of these phenomena were all facets of the same diamond. And maybe the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, like a true gestalt, you know, to this whole, you know, thing of high strangeness. So I don't call myself a paranormal researcher. I don't call myself a, you know, cryptologist. I don't call myself a ufologist, even though I am a MUFON field investigator. I called myself a weird crapologist. If it's weird, I want to check it out. So, you know, that's kind of me. You know, if something weird is going on, you know, if it's a hairy beast, you know, back in Paw Paw's bean field, as we say down here in the southern U.S., or it's, you know, something rattling the chains in Edna's attic, you know, I want to check it out.
I mean, it's something that I've always been fascinated with. I think these days it's not as prevalent as it used to be, as you refer to in that example you've just given there, Trey. It is surprising for me sometimes, and you can only look back, and I'm sure you've had these thoughts as well, of how many incidents of weirdness we've had that have happened to Bigfooters, and they've just ignored it because it's not Bigfoot, and ghost hunters because it's not ghosts, and, and ufologists because it's not. And sometimes it is a little bit frustrating, but I think over the last sort of 20 years, it seems that a lot of people have rediscovered John Keel. They've seen the kind of work that other people are doing who focus on strangeness. The Newkirks are a prime example of people that seem to cover everything, who once again have come from the paranormal and have found themselves pulled into it, along with their colleague who often does, John Turney, who works alongside them on a fair bit. Paul, who we've mentioned, yourself and your team. I mean, you've got a couple of other areas in the US as well, which are very famous. Bridgewater is probably the most notable one, Trey. And it seems that these lines aren't there anymore for some of us that are open-minded, because as you said in the book, and I mentioned in the introduction, you've got to follow the folklore, you've got to follow the stories and the witnesses. And fair play to you, because I think if you are sort of grounded in the paranormal, it would be very easy for you to have not done that.
Right.
Do you? I know you've always had an interest in strangeness and as you say, that trifecta that a lot of us get into when we're into it. We suddenly discover everything and we just, you know, we're like a kid in a candy shop. A very weird one, but that's how we seem to be sometimes. Why did you push through that? Did you never have that, Trey? You just associated with ghosts, but you were still interested in everything else, and it's just happened that way.
You know, I always had a healthy interest in, you know, pretty much everything. You know, I like I said, I grew up in the 70s. There was a fantastic television show back in the 70s called In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy. And they talked about all kinds of strange things. So, you know, I was this, you know, twisted little maladaptive sponge, you know, at a young age, just absorbing all of this stuff. And, you know, I always had an interest in, you know, ghosts, you know, that was just kind of something that I gravitated towards. And of course, you know, studying under William Roll, you know, how can you do anything but, you know, kind of veer towards, you know, the paranormal. Yes. So, you know, that's kind of how I started. And we actually were approaching the region of the meadow, not the meadow itself, but we were actually tracking down folklore. Is there was a supposedly folkloric haunted road that was built over a cemetery, you know, and it was the very, you know, all of the cliches and archetypes, you know, the ghost would come up out of the road and leave their greasy fingerprints along the side of your, you know, the bonnet of your automobile as you would drive away, and all, you know, all of these things like that. And so that's where I wanted to go. And it turns out while we were investigating the haunted road, you know, where, you know, down here in the South, they call them haints, you know, don't let the haints get you. There's nothing happening on the haunted road. It was a complete bust. But as so often happens in this business, back at base camp, our base camp guy had a fantastic UFO experience, just a really, really rich UFO experience. And so we thought, forget that haunted road business. You know, that's all bunk. Let's go check out this, you know, this around this base camp. And probably about 3/4 of a mile from base camp, we found a large open field. And it's like, you know, this would be a really cool place to do, you know, a multifaceted research for several reasons. Number one, it's a big open field. Something moves across it like a cryptid, because this area is also known for, you know, Bigfoot that we were researching. It's going to leave a track line. Number two, you can set up teams on the periphery with night vision and thermal, and they'll catch anything moving across it. Number three is there's a large ridge to the south that you can put teams up on top of the ridge looking down. And number four, it has a big expanse of open sky, because this area has the number three of the trifecta, also a lot of UFOs. So it just so happens we decided to start using this meadow because logistically it made a lot of sense for the type of research we were doing. And it turned out to be just an absolutely, you know, unbelievable gold mine of high strangeness.
I suppose with your education and your career as well, Trey, not many people have that kind of insight that your education and your career has provided, I suspect, that perhaps has enabled you to come at this more open-minded than someone who would have just been entrenched in the paranormal because of what you've learned and where your life has taken you. Do you think that that's given you more of an insight into the strangeness, Trey, rather than trying to explain things away more? Because not just because you were educated under Roll, but also how those, you know, how your degree and life has taken you in your career and the things that you've had to do in, as part of the Army.
Well, you know, number one is, you know, I could say it very easy. I could say, you know, I have the attention span of a banana slug and I get bored. So I'm going to go where something's happening. But, you know, that's just kind of superficial. Really, you know, probably what I'm going to pin it on is my university program. Is my degree is in humanistic and transpersonal psychology, which is very much psychology of the human being, you know, the human experience. And, you know, like I said, I studied under William Roll, Mike Ahrens, who was a student of Abraham Maslow, Chris Ann Stuess, you know, all, Don Rice, all of these luminaries, you know, were my professors. And so I really gained an appreciation for the experiential nature of the human journey, the human voyage. But I also, you know, as a former Army intelligence guy, I also have to look at the data. I have to look at empirical, you know, stuff. So what we try to do with the Anomalous Studies and Observation Group is we keep one foot in the empirical. You know, we take, you know, EMFs out there. We take our thermals. We take our night vision cameras, Geiger counters, you know, the whole range, you know, all of this stuff. You know, we also take ghost boxes and other stuff out of other genres. But we also really focus on the experience, because in my opinion, you can have all the empirical data you want, but if there's not a human being to experience it, what's the point? Why bother? Because as human beings, we're all making this journey together, and the essence and the nuggets and the marrow to squeeze out of that journey are our experiences, not only individually, but collectively.
I suppose as well, it gives you a better insight as well when you're dealing with witnesses as well, Trey, because you can kind of understand the language and the feelings and the, and as you say, people's experience of the same phenomena can be very different for a numerous amount of reasons. And therefore that possibly gives you an insight into why does somebody react in the way? And also probably why do people not see something that perhaps somebody they're with does, or they experience one thing and the somebody or another member of the team or even more so does not have that. And I've always found that a fascinating aspect of strangeness is where you will have a collection of people and you might have four people and they've all got a very different interpretation as to what's just happened to them.
Yeah, you know, that's something when I lecture, I have a slide that comes up. And on one side of the slide is the famous painting, the Mona Lisa. You know, everybody's familiar with the Mona Lisa. And then on the right side of the painting, there's a bunch of gents with toilet paper tubes. And they're all looking at the Mona Lisa through these toilet paper tubes. And they're all wearing T-shirts. And one says religion. One says science. You know, one says, opinions. You know, one says, just all their biases, you know, whatever that bias is, you know. And only until they take the toilet paper tube down do they get to see the full picture. So something that I really encourage, people to do, not only in this business, but just basically in life, is really examine your own bias. Now, there's nothing wrong with having, one thing that's, near and dear to people is their belief system, their spiritual belief system. That's fine. Mm. I have my own belief system, but also realize that sometimes that can kind of limit the way you look at things and be aware of that bias. You don't get rid of it, but just be aware of it and how it might cloud your perception. And more importantly, how it might differ from somebody else's perception, kind of like what you were talking about. So, we have bias and we're all coming into these experiences from a different place. I had an experience not too long ago where I was part of a quick reaction force that went in to get a team, extract them from an event of extreme high strangeness. And one of the individuals dealing with this has PTSD from military service. So he was having a very extreme reaction to this because that's where he was coming from. So I had to be aware of that, so I dealt with him in a way maybe a little bit different than, maybe the other team member who had a medical background. So, that's we're all human beings and we're all trying to make sense of this crazy stuff, whether it be trying to pay your gas bill or trying to deal with high strangeness, and we're just kind of stumbling out through the dark together.
I suppose when this started, because essentially, as you say, you kind of stumbled on this by looking for a haunted road that didn't seem sounds particularly haunted.
Yeah,
but
no,
as with anything, Trey, I think we both know there are thousands of those.
They make great stories.
Yeah. Was it a case of trying things from personal experience? Because obviously your team has lots of different skill sets. Mm-hmm. You seem to have people from all walks of life and all sides of the paranormal prison,
right,
in regards to that, or the Fortean world, as it were. And so everybody's got different skill sets. They can bring something different to the table. Was it a case of people said, well, I think we should use this. I think we should use that. Because often what you get, and sometimes I find this quite frustrating, is especially in cryptozoology, people will try certain things. And if it doesn't work, they'll just try something else. Right. Whereas I've always been a believer of throwing as much against the wall and see what sticks. Mm-hmm. Because if we're talking about multifaceted phenomenon, it might not appear on certain things. And one of the things that's always struck me about you and your team is this ability to utilize a variety of equipment, of recording devices, of different things, different tactics. You don't seem to keep still. You like to mix it up. You like to see what works, but also go back to things that maybe not have given a result at specific times. You've not pushed them to the side. You've just thought, oh, well, we'll try that somewhere else, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. We and something we try to do is we actually go out in the field with an agenda, and it's not a rigid agenda, but we go out and we have an idea of what we're going to do. First of all, time is a valuable resource. It's not infinite, and we have to really maximize the return on our investment of time whenever we're out in the field. And so we'll do things like I'll design an experimental package. Like my latest experimental package is a base, a wooden base, probably, 18 inches by 18 inches with compartments broken up in it. And I'll put different small avatars, like a small toy car, a miniature of the pyramid, at Giza, a little statue of Buddha. And then I have a cap shaped like a pyramid that goes on top of it. This is actually anchored into the ground and locked. It's aligned north to south, and we leave that. And then we come back, we open it up, and we see if anything has changed, orientation of little avatars or if anything's been moved. Hmm. And so we're always trying new experiments, and those are kind of similar to some of the Surratt experiments that were done at Duke University, and some of that kind of stuff. And we also do stuff very similar to the skull experiment.
Yes.
Where we'll take instead of using 35 millimeter film, we'll take an SD card, seal it, put it inside of a waterproof box, leave it, and see if something is imprinted on that. Now, so far, it's been negative. But those are like very rigid, controlled, paranormal type of experiments. But we also do things like the Estes method. We'll try the Estes method out there, which we've had fantastic results, which I'm going to be bold and say it appears as though we are communicating with a non-human intelligence using the Estes method. So, you know, like you said, we have a very big toolbox, and we're not afraid to bring tools from other disciplines into the toolbox and quite frankly, see if they work. CE5 protocol developed by Dr. Greer, we try that. We had some crazy results from that, not what we were expecting, and it did not manifest in a way that CE5 sessions usually manifest, but we did get a result. So we have to be flexible enough to try different things, but also broad-minded enough to realize a response when we get it, and albeit might come from a very, very different spot.
Mm. I suppose this is one of the aspects of this, because, I mean, I've seen some of the footage over the years, Trey, that you've shared, and you've been on, you've been on a couple of TV programs. Oh, yeah. It is fascinating to me because, like you say, there doesn't seem to be an overarching phenomena going on. There seems to be just weird things. There is something remarkable about this, and also the fact that your team have kind of embraced it and run with it, because I don't think you could have achieved the results and the recordings and the evidence and the data that you've gathered by having such a rigid agenda that has no flexibility to it. And therefore, what's served you all very well is the fact that you've got that ability to adapt and to change. And so is it a case of you have designated sort of experiments or plans that you put in place at certain times of the year, Trey? Or is it just how you feel on that particular plan?
I would say yes to both of them. That's kind of sounds like an easy out. But, we do go in there with an agenda. You know, this trip we're going to try, da-da-da-da-da, or when we're getting ready for a evening's investigation, this is how we're going to set up. We're going to have teams, 1, 2, 3, and 4 are going to be in this position. Their equipment loadouts are going to be, this team will have, Geiger counters. This team will have thermals, and so we actually go in with, some sort of idea. But we use a military model. Not that we're a military organization, but we use a military model because it works. Hmm. And, an old saying is the best military plan goes out the window at first enemy contact, meaning you have to be flexible. In every operation, we have an operational commander who is in charge of the overall expedition for the weekend or week or whatever. And then we have a tactical command who is actually in charge of the being out there in the field. And the tactical commander has the ability to move his or her units around however he or she sees fit. But nobody moves off station without permission. That way we're not contaminating somebody else's area of research. And so, we've had that happen to where we have had, stuff just come out of left field and we will move teams around. So you have to have a really experienced person as your tactical commander. And, we have people from emergency fire services, military people that have that experience of moving tactical assets around and making sure they don't start working on top of one another. And you have to have that flexibility, but you also have to have an order and a structure to that flexibility, or it's going to just disintegrate into chaos. And so many times, I hear about, let's say, groups that are researching that might not have the professional background as other groups, and they'll go out and they'll have maybe a thermal app on their phone, a voice recorder, and then when something happens, they really don't have a plan on how to deal with it. They're not prepared operationally. They're not prepared logistically. They're not prepared psychologically. And they're not prepared spiritually. And it can devolve into absolute chaos really, really quick. So I'm going to throw that warning out there. And that's going to be touched on in the film that I have coming out. This is serious stuff. You said you've been out there with Paul. Is this can get really ugly really quick, and it can really mess a person up psychologically, and unfortunately, I hate to say this, it can mess a person up physically. You know, there are people that have physical injuries. There are people that are dead working with this stuff. And so, you know, one thing I always throw out there to the listeners is be very careful if you want to get into this business, because it is very serious. And, you know, it can have very long lasting implications for the rest of your life.
It is surprising, I think, even still, Trey, in this day and age, how often you see people who are very unprepared doing things, even on just a standard wildlife issue. You've got to, as with anything, you should prepare for the worst,
right?
In any aspect. And often, especially when you're in remote locations, it's not the wildlife often that you're going to be more concerned about. It's the random person who just turns up in the middle of the woods, which is usually, that puts everybody on high alert, because often you're thinking, why on earth are you here?
Right. Yeah. The general area, and I'm talking general, like 20 miles from where we're located in this big wildlife preserve, we've actually had cult murders within the past 3 years. You know, people being murdered by cultists. So, you know, when we go out, you know, here in the United States, we have something called the Second Amendment. You know, so we're prepared, you know, and, you know, we're very cognizant of that potential threat. But you're talking about people being, you know, ill prepared is, you know, we have protocols we follow. One protocol is you never go out in the field without communications. You always have a radio. We have a set radio frequency, you know, and everybody knows what that frequency is. We always go out in pairs, because the one time that we had a person go out by themselves, it got weird really fast. And we always have some way to recover somebody. Like I said, just a few weeks ago, I was part of a quick reaction force that had to go in and get a team that was experiencing extreme high strangeness, extreme disorientation, David Pilates kind of stuff, missing 411 kind of stuff, and extract that team out. So, you know, you have to have a, you know, it's great when everything is going great. It's not so great when everything isn't going great. So, you know, all plans are great until they're not. And you have to be prepared for that.
In regards to how you've investigated and planned and prepared for this particular location over, I don't know, nearly a decade now, Trey, really, did you consider going to other areas of high strangeness in the US to kind of get a feel as to it? Because obviously, as I said, you've got a background in army intelligence. You've been out in Afghanistan. You've seen the worst that the world can throw at people. It is strange sometimes that people might consider bringing those kind of, you know, without wishing to sound like I'm being flippant about this, those real world kind of skill sets to a Fortean subject. But more often than not, it needs to have its foot in the real world, regardless of everything else that's happening on top of it, Trey. So was it a situation where you decided to have a look at other areas and what other teams were doing? And not necessarily copy, but learn best practice and share ideas.
Absolutely. You know, I served 34 years as a U.S. federal security specialist, you know, for the U.S. government. You know, like you said, I went to Afghanistan. And one thing we always had in that business is something we call benchmarking, which is basically a fancy word of stealing other people's tactics, techniques, and procedures, you know, because it works. You know, if you're doing something and it works really well, I'm going to use it. You know, I've absolutely borrowed other, you know, things from, you know, other teams and other people, because they absolutely work. Probably, and you mentioned him earlier, one of the biggest influences on the way I look at this is a legendary John Keel. You know, he had such a very mature way of looking at high strangeness that the term that I use in my book and, you know, whenever I speak of paradimensionals evolved directly from his term ultra-terrestrials. You know, it's basically an evolution of his concept of ultra-terrestrials, which I call paradimensionals. So, you know, truly, I stand on the shoulders of giants. You know, and I'm also standing adjacent to giants. Like you mentioned, Paul Sinclair, Steve Mira, Philip Mantle, you know, a lot of folks over there in the UK that are friends of mine. Over here, you know, Katie Page, you know, is a very good friend of mine. You know, and just I try to work with everybody. And one of the big things that I'm trying to push is, as researchers, let's share data. You know, if I have something that's working in my thing, you know, in my area or in my particular circumstance, that I'm getting results, hey, maybe you ought to try it at yours. Maybe you'll get results. Maybe you won't. But I might prevent you from having to spin your wheels for 3 or 4 years trying to come up with something that, you know, just, you know, that I already know. So that's something I would like to see more of, is more sharing among the among researchers. And that's what I tell people when they come out and are guest researchers at the Meadow. I've had Josh Kutchin, Katie Page, you know, quite a few guest researchers come out. Tony Merkel, I don't know if you know him. He's a radio guy here in the he actually came and made a film, which will be coming out on Sunday. And my attitude has always been, you know, the only thing I ask that you keep secret is the location. Because if the location is compromised, I'm going to have a bunch of knuckleheads come out here and ruin it. I mean, I hate to sound elitist, but it's the truth. But if you come and investigate and research with it, your experience is your experience. It's not mine. Take that, spread it to the world. Because, you know, it's your lived experience. It's your lived situation. And I want you to share that, because the Meadow's not my story. It's the world's story. And the world deserves to hear it. That's why I wrote the books, so everybody could share in the experience. At best, they could be enlightened. At worst, they're merely entertained. But nevertheless, they get the information.
Yes. Well, it's always been a problem, hasn't it? Gatekeeping, I think, Craig.
Yeah.
You know, particularly in this field.
It is, you know, I have been very lucky. You know, God has blessed me in many, many ways. I'm of independent means. You know, I don't, you know, money isn't really a big concern with me. So I'm not getting, you know, I'm not trying to get rich doing this. Now, not that any of us get rich. I mean, you know, probably as well as I do, is you can go talk to big names in this business and they're not making a lot of money. You know, they're... You know, they're having to work other jobs. So, you know, I'm not in this to make money. I'm not in this to get rich. I'm not in this for fame or fortune or anything like that. Or, as you know, Indiana Jones said, fortune and glory. I just want to share this story because I think it's so cool. Here we are in the 21st century. You know, we've got, you know, this thing, you know, my cell phone, which literally, when I was watching the original Star Trek series, this was science fiction. This is a tricorder and a communicator and all that other stuff rolled into one. Yeah. And we think we have all the answers. You know, when I was at university, we had to go to the thing called the library and open up things called books and make notes. Now it's at our fingertips. But even in the 21st century, there are still mysteries. There are still things that make us scratch our heads and go, that's what I'm excited about. And that's what I want to share with the world.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
I mean, there are numerous examples of this, Trey, because I completely understand why you want to keep this location private. Because we've seen in the past when there's been specific areas, I think the probably the most famous one that's happened in the last 10 years was Area X, which was apparently a Bigfoot hotspot.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the wrong people got invited, and then all of a sudden, everybody knew where it was.
Yeah.
And I suppose you've got to be very careful, but I don't see that as a negative. I think how you're trying to achieve this and look at this and utilize the skills and interest of other researchers from other fields is a benefit. I think that's a fair exchange. You know, you come and share, you take what you want, but the only thing you keep is the location.
Right.
Because we all know that people will just turn up and start running amok. And you've got to be careful with that, because it does become a free-for-all. And that's when bad things can happen.
Yeah, it can get, you know, somebody could go out there lacking the maturity of researching and the, you know, just basically the real boots on the ground common sense. And somebody could get hurt, you know, really easy. But you were talking about, you know, a Bigfoot place being outed. is I'd gone one time with a, invited to go up to Uwari National Forest in the Carolinas, huge big Bigfoot area. And I was staying at a place called Yates Place, which is very well known in the Bigfoot world. Nobody was there when we set up camp Friday night, woke up Saturday morning, and the place was absolutely packed. So we tried to do research Saturday night. So every whoop or, you know, tree knock you heard, you didn't know if that was somebody else. Is that an orb I see, or is that somebody else's flashlight? And it was just, it was a joke.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we just kind of gave up and ended up sitting around the campfire. And I also had a chance to sit down and talk to Mr. Dwayne Ollinger, who owns a place in Utah called Blind Frog Ranch.
Yes.
And once that location got out, and I actually had a chance to go to Blind Frog Ranch, is you will see the pits that people have snuck in there and dug trying to look for treasure and other things because that area was outed. So, you know, and of course you have the legendary Skinwalker Ranch that now Brandon Fugel has to have armed security on the site 24/7 because when it was outed, you had all kinds of people trespassing on it. So, you know, I'm trying to avoid that so this research area can be kept as pristine as long as possible. Because, you know, as long as I'm able to and, you know, my body holds out, I'm going to be out there researching.
Absolutely. I think this is the thing. It's invigorating and it's refreshing, Trey, because like I say, it's nice to appreciate that you've got this very holistic approach to what you're trying to achieve here. Because you want to share it. You don't want to keep it. You're not sort of teasing people and whatever. You're very open. Every time I've heard you speak, be it on another show or I've seen one of your lectures at a conference or something, or when you've appeared on television, you're very open. You're quite happy to share these things. It is remarkable, some of the things you've caught over the years.
Yeah.
And if it's all right, I'd like to dive into some of them,
please.
If that's okay. I mean, you've had all kinds of incidents of balls of light and almost as if things are transforming and reappearing in different parts and speeds and all kinds of things. So for anybody who's not aware of these kind of aspects, Trey, how did you kind of stumble across this? Because obviously, as we've mentioned, you've got a very big toolbox that you utilize here.
Well, you know, one of the first times we went out was in, I told you about the big UFO experience that we had while we were at the Haunted Row. We decided to go back out and really look at this this big field because, you know, it was kind of a cool place logistically to look. And that was in July of 2016. So this is 9 years ago. And what we decided we were going to do that night is we were going to set up teams on the periphery of the meadow with night vision and thermal. And then we were going to have a single individual walk across the top of the ridge to the south and maybe flush something down into the meadow that we could pick up with our equipment.
Mm.
Well, it turns out that the meadow had been waiting for us, had been lurking, and was going to really show out our first go at this place. Is the individual that was going to be the ridge walker, the single solo individual, had left something back at base camp. So he radioed and says, hey, I have to go back to base camp. Everybody stay in position. I'll let you know when I start walking on the top of the ridge. The next radio transmission we have from him is him reaching a well-known landmark on the trail to the meadow. It was a tree across the trail. And he says, I reached the tree across the trail, and I don't know how I got here. So our chief medic that weekend got on the radio and was going to do a virtual medical assessment because we're thinking maybe a stroke. You know,
yes.
Do you have numbness, you know, in your extremities? Well, no. You know, squeeze your fist together. Do they feel equal in strength? Yes. Repeat a simple sentence. Say, Mary had a little lamb. And he repeated all of this. You know, did you fall? Do you have a headache? No, 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 no. And so the first thing we did is we opened up our normalcy bias and we jumped right in. Obviously, he was just thinking about something else and not paying attention. And just, you know, we tried to normalize it, which is one of the biggest mistakes that a researcher can do. And we did it. You know, we normalized it. And the cool thing is we went back and put this individual under hypnotic regression years later. And the hypnotherapist went to that particular time and place, and I was in the room when this happened, and said, tell us about the time you left the camp until you got to the tree across the trail. And the subject said, it is completely blank. I have no, this was under hypnosis, no recollection no memory. I just became conscious when I got to that landmark. So, you know, so that was our first, taste of it. So that was a pretty, big bite of the apple right there. And so, he, you know, everybody kind of gets repositioned and, you know, we all ponded off into a normal occurrence, which it turns out it wasn't. He moves across the top of the ridge. He moves from east to west, drops down into the west end of the meadow and starts working his way back across. One of my teams picks up his headlamp visually. Now, the team that was watching him were made up of two individuals. One individual is a was a career paramedic, fire services guy, has a master's degree in public administration, graduated from a very prestigious university here in the United States, Georgia Institute of Technology, very grounded guy. The second guy had dual degrees from Georgia Tech, philosophy and physics, was a U.S. Army Ranger with the 75th Ranger Regiment, special operations guy, and now is working on AI applications for one of the big automakers. So two very solid, educated guys, not some flighty individuals, really solid guys. So they're watching the individual come down off the ridge, and they bring their thermals up, and they see him, and they drop their thermals, and all of a sudden where he was, they see this ball of light appear. And this ball of light moves, 100 meters or so, and winks out, and they quickly bring their thermals back up, and they see him standing there, or see a man man-shaped heat signature. So they get on their radio. Yeah. Hey, Bob, are you okay? And they're watching this through their thermals, and they see this heat signature bring a radio up to its mouth. And then all of a sudden the radio breaks squelch, and they says, yes, I'm fine. Why? You need to come over to us. So he comes over to them, and they say, you know, are you okay? Yes, I'm fine. Why? We just saw you turn into a ball of light and move, you know, 100 meters or so. And we calculated that ball of light moved at about 26 miles per hour. Are you okay? Yes, I'm fine. What are you talking about? We saw you turn into a ball of light. No, I didn't. I just walked over here. And they go, no, we saw it. Well, you're crazy because I just walked over here. And when you really start dissecting that, what you had are two states of reality quite different existing at the same place at the same time. One reality where he was a ball of light and moved at a very high rate of speed. The other reality where he just walked normally. And it was based on their perspective. It was kind of like the observer effect. And it was like Schrodinger's cat. Both realities existed at the same time. So what you're talking about now are quantum effects at a macro level. Two realities, yes. Two states existing in a macro sense. So I don't know about you, but I find that kind of exciting.
Yes.
So, you know, we were like, heck, this is the first time we've been out here. And for a lot of, high strangeness researchers or phenomenologists, this would be the apex of their career. You know, this would be like the Mount Everest. You know, it can't get any better than this. Mm. So, we go back to our base camp. Base camp operator saw mysterious orbs on the ridge above base camp. We saw a white hominid, you know, Sasquatch-type creature watching the camp late at night. So all of this is happening in, you know, one day. The next day, Bob, the ridge guy, the guy that turned into the ball of light, the guy that's missing time, comes up with his GPS. And he has a background in backcountry search and rescue. Mm. So he always leaves the breadcrumb or tracking option on his GPS activated. Yeah. So it follows his track line. And he showed us his track line and he says, look at this. This is really weird. And it showed him being on the other side of a small river. It had several straight track lines for a few kilometers each. And it had him being places that he never went to. A couple of things that are interesting is they were straight lines. You cannot move in a straight line over this terrain. Mm-hmm. And he was in places that he doesn't remember going to. So if the terrain is too rugged to move in a straight line, either via vehicle or via foot, how can you move in a straight line over rugged terrain in the air? He had missing time.
Yeah.
And like so many times, we told him, you know, when you get home, download this data. We'll bring it up in our Garmin apps on our computers, and we'll do an analysis of it. And we'll pull the metadata out and do all that. And by the time he got home, everything was erased off his GPS. It was gone. Happens so many times in these areas of high strangeness is data is erased, electronics malfunction, I wish I had a nickel for every time I heard people talk about their equipment and say it's never done this before, because in this place it will. So that was one weekend. You know, that was our kickoff.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's just one thing. And that, I haven't even gotten into the portal yet. You know, which is another crazy thing.
I suppose. I mean, the first question is: was there any sort of hangover for Bob in regards to this? Because as you say, when he sort of went back and had some regressive hypnosis, the fact that there's nothing there is even odder than a screen memory, perhaps, Trey, or even let's be open minded about this. Even saying, well, yes, this light came down and I was taken, and whatever, for nothing to be there and categorically state that, I find that stranger than him having some kind of explanation.
Yeah, and the hypnotherapist thought that was kind of odd too, and he said, I think that something has blanked that. There is a suggestion that is blanking out that period of time for some reason. Now, unfortunately, like happens in other people that have experienced high strangeness, he's not with us anymore. After these experiences, his cancer returned with a vengeance.
Oh.
So we never had a chance to do a follow-on hypnotic session with him.
I suppose it's mystifying. I mean, especially when we talk about the makeup of the team and the experiences that you all have. The fact that you're going through the steps to map yourselves and to check in, to have waypoints. I mean, obviously, as you explained in the first book, you've got a long love of geocaching, which essentially is sort of treasure hunting for nerds like us.
Yeah.
And so you have to have an ability to understand and record and track and do everything. And these days, especially, even if you don't realize it, your phone will cover you and tell you where you've been and elevations and all kinds of things. So when you then look at using specialist recording equipment and that starts to fail, but it doesn't fail at the time, it fails when you need to get the data, that then starts to conjure up thoughts of, is this being deliberately manipulated? Is there something in this area that once you get out of the envelope of it, perhaps, Trey, it's like an automatic delete.
You know, that's a good and fair point. And something that kind of addresses that is, and let me look at my notes right here. We had done decided to do an SD session.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, November of 2019. And, you know, we're going through the SD session and, you know, it appears as though we're established two-way communications with a non-human intelligence.
Hmm.
And this was after, you know, the portal experience. So one thing as a former intel guy is I'm always looking for indicators and signatures, you know, certain things that may be an indicator that high strangeness is getting ready to happen. You know, be it a radiation spike, an EMF spike, a feeling of, you know, a particular physical feeling. And so I'm trying to drill down into some of the phenomenologies. Now, one of the phenomenologies that, you know, may explain some of this stuff are micro singularities or tiny black holes. There's some speculation that we have these appearing in our atmosphere. I'm talking ionosphere, very high up. But as you have plasma and solar radiation interacting, causing these tiny micro singularities, which would explain tiny micro bursts of very low levels of radiation. So that was kind of, I was thinking along those lines. And, you know, that could also explain some time differences like Steve Mira talks about, you know.
Yes.
And so anyway, I was going down that line of thought, you know, I'm going to mention some phenomenologies. Do they have anything to do with the meadow or the portal? And I said, you know, plasma, radiation, you know, and the entity gets very agitated. Very, very angry with us. Like it does not want us to go down that line of questioning. And so I have to wonder is, you know, maybe we get too close to the truth. You know, maybe we're just something other than just ants on the side of the road to this entity. Maybe, you know, it's doing something, I'm not going to say nefarious, but maybe something that it just doesn't want us to know about. And if we start going to that line of questioning, it will, you know, kind of rear back and, you know, react. And maybe that's what this, you know, erasure of our data and the malfunctioning of equipment is a manifestation of.
I mean, the Estes method is interesting. I used to think perhaps it was all stuff and nonsense, try until I did it.
Yeah.
And I think when you do it, after it changes you, I have to say. And I did it in a haunted location. And yeah. I'd seen other people do it over the years. Right. You know, I've watched a lot and seen a lot. And I thought, well, I got the opportunity to do it for free at a location I'd never been to before. I did it and it blew me away, I have to say. And the thing for me, I don't know what it's like for you guys when you've done it over there. The one thing that I took from that was it seemed like 5 minutes, but I did it for 45. Yeah. And I couldn't believe how long I'd been out of it, really. And so when I came out of it, because I often used to think, do those earphones really, are they really, can you hear anything? Can you see through your blindfold? No, none of it was true. It was all, I couldn't hear or see anything. I had no idea other than the noises that were coming through the headphones tray. And so that really gave me pause for, yes, there was a lot of chatter and nonsense that came through, but there was a lot of really compelling, coincidental information that I had no idea about. And didn't know what every, because I was in a room with five people and they were doing things and taking notes as I was speaking what I was hearing. And that really challenged my perception of that. And once again, it made me realise that, as you say about bias, I went into that bias thinking it was stuff and nonsense. And I came out of it, those shackles had been removed from me and I'm really intrigued to try it somewhere else in different things. But I wouldn't have considered doing it in the way that you guys have done until I saw your work.
Right.
And then it made sense to me that you would try something like that. Because if we're looking at the perception of high strangeness and different signatures and radiation levels and the way that certain elements react in certain environments, there's a good chance that is going to pick something up. It's not just for ghosts.
Yeah, no. You know, and that's kind of, I've changed my attitude, you know, and originally, these are, spirits of the dead Uncle Fred, trapped, yes. He hasn't crossed over, all of that stuff. And I don't mean to make light of that, people that believe
no.
that. That's their belief that, that's what these spirits are. And as I've researched, as I've talked to scientists, as I've had my own experiences, as I've monitored the experiences of others, I am coming to the realization that we're probably dealing with extra-dimensional beings. And they're just as curious about us as perhaps we are of them. Mm. And, there's nothing, mysterious about it. It's just another realm of reality that sometimes we can kind of poke our finger through and data and information and communications can pass through. Mm. And so when I started looking at things from a multidimensional perspective, and I put on my ufologist hat, I don't necessarily think that UFOs are our space brothers getting in their intergalactic Cadillac and driving over here from Zeta Reticuli, cruising down the intergalactic highway. I think that the craft are multidimensional. Okay. I think that they are something other than what they appear to be. So now I take that thought process and I move it forward into what we're experiencing in the meadow and other places. What if these multidimensional beings, let's do a thought experiment. They're multidimensional. We cannot ascertain their true nature. As a tesseract is a three-dimensional shadow of a four-dimensional object where all the angles are right angles, where a drawing of a cube is a two-dimensional shadow or representation of a three-dimensional object.
Yes.
What if what we're experiencing are multidimensional aspects of a single object? What if one aspect of this being, as it drops down into our three dimensions, appears to us as maybe a cryptid. But then as it comes up into its higher dimension and drops back down in our dimension again, we see another aspect of it. Like your toe or your finger doesn't look like your ear. They're totally different, but they're all part of the same being.
Yes.
So one aspect of this thing may appear to be a cryptid one time. As it drops back out down in our dimension, it looks like a UFO. As it drops back down in our dimension, it's a ghost. And they're all different aspects of a multidimensional object being reduced down into our dimensions, but they're all part of the same phenomena. Mm. They're all part of the same intelligence. Mm. And so when we start looking at it like that, now you start to have the gestalt of high strangeness coming together, and it's like, it's all the same thing. So let's start looking at it as the same thing and stop, like you alluded to earlier, stop pigeonholing ourselves into these very narrow definitions and genres and research methodologies. Mm. And let's have a much broader view.
I must admit, when I started on this journey several years ago, Trey, I didn't realize I'd have to start diving back into the world of physics since leaving school, right. I have to say.
Oh, yeah.
My understanding of quantum mechanics has come on so much in the last 3 or 4 years.
We've actually established something called the Meadow Cooperative.
Yeah.
And it's scientists and other people, and Steve Muir is part of it. And we're really looking at this thing from a quantum perspective.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff that we're coming up with is just absolutely phenomenal.
Mm.
I mean, things that, you know, we never thought about. We're looking at, you know, quantum tunneling. We're looking at, you know, different aspects of phasing,
yeah.
you know, and all of this stuff. And it's really starting to make a lot of sense. If you look at things at the smallest level, there's a reason that quantum entanglement is called spooky action at a distance.
Yes.
Because it's spooky.
Yeah.
It looks like it's freaking paranormal.
Yeah.
And if we start looking at this stuff on a macro scale, it starts to make sense, you know, if we look at it through that particular optic.
Yeah. I have to say, one of the best sort of caveats I heard in regards to this is that I think Michio Kaku said, if anybody tells you they understand how quantum mechanics works, they're lying. Nobody does. And so I think that gives everybody a bit of a clear slate and a run at this, because the whole concept of how we view our place in the universe and how we move through time and space has changed so much and seems to be changing every few months these days, Trey. There seems to be a real pace in regards to some of these theories. And it for me, the whole kind of, as you alluded to earlier, where you've got essentially two points of time running at different levels existing in the same dimension at the same time.
Yes.
Kind of leads you into that kind of multi-dimensional crossovers that you could get. But it also, like you say, because of what happened as we touched on, I'd love to dive into in regards to the portal, is that you also have these kind of examples where we look at, say, the Einstein-Rosen bridge, which most people would know as a wormhole, really.
Right.
But that concept of shortcuts through time and space that could be there, but it depends which dimension it is. And for me, I found it fascinating how, as you say about pigeonholing us and having certain beliefs and things, for me, I used to be a very much all or nothing. It's this, not that. It's this, not that. Which now I realise was very silly of me. And I think, yes, there are certain things that happen in the world where I think it can be perhaps prescribed a sort of explanation that you know it fits the parameters of that particular experience. But I think when you've got something like this, everything's happening. There's no rhyme or reason to it. There's no recipe going on here. There's no instruction book. It's you've just got to basically be as flexible as the phenomena wants you to be. And that seems to be one of the key strengths that you and your team have, is that you can adapt and change to these things.
Well, yeah, and thank you. I mean, we try to be very adaptive. And one thing I tell people, if you encounter someone that tells you they know what's going on, they're either lying or they're a fool, because nobody knows what's going on.
Yes.
And you know, during all these interviews, you know, one of the big questions I get is what do you think is going on? And I always answer it thus: is not only do I not have the answers, I don't even really know what the proper questions are.
Mm.
I mean, I am the proverbial ant on the side of the freeway trying to figure out what a road is.
Yes.
You know, I have no frame of reference.
Mm.
So sometimes you just have to kind of, you know, sit back, put your helmet on, you know, strap yourself into the ejection seat and go with it and just let the experience happen, and then try to, you know, piece it together, you know, later on, you talk to some really smart people and try to come up with a hypothesis. But, you know, nobody really knows what's going on with this. You know, that kind of makes it exciting.
Mm.
But the other side of that coin is it kind of makes it a little scary, too.
Mm. Absolutely. Well, to be honest, Trey, I think the thing about exploration on whatever level, you know, it's not just travel and discovery. It's all kinds of things. Is I think sometimes there has to be a bit of fear. And something a little bit frightening. It's the fear of what might happen that often drives the most intrepid of people to push through that fear and try and get the answers. And as you say, one of the great strengths of yourself and your team is that you're not trying to tell us what's happening. You're simply saying, this is happening. I don't know why, but this is what we're capturing.
Right. You know, and you mentioned travel is every new discovery, be it travel, you know, some sort of epiphany through literature, every new discovery lacks punch unless it has some sort of existential kick in the pants.
Yes.
That really makes you back up, take a deep breath, and look at your place in the world of the universe, you know, your family, your community, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And that's how we grow. And when people are not experiencing that existential kick in the pants when they make a discovery or they're exposed to something new, they're not growing. Mm. And I think that's the biggest thing is by not having the answers and albeit not even having the questions, every time we experience something, we're growing. Mm. And we reach out to other people that might have, you know, similar experiences, might have another area of expertise that maybe, you know, moves us just a millimeter closer to the answer without ever actually making it over the finish line. Mm.
Mm. And that's, to be fair, that's how we should approach these things, really, because
I think so.
As you say, you can travel the world, but if you don't go to the right places or find that enrichment on whatever level that connects with you somehow, Trey, then it's a pointless journey. Yeah, you've been somewhere nice, but you know, it's like going to Rome and just staying in your hotel for a week.
Right.
You know, and you're a man that likes to travel. I know you've been to Europe fairly recently.
Oh yeah.
You've got to go to these places. You've got to find these things out because it amazes me sometimes that people, if they go abroad, they'll just go somewhere where they can lie on a sun lounger for a week. Now I like to chill out with the best of them, Trey. But I also like to make sure if I go somewhere incredible like Rome or Bilbao or Budapest, then I want to go in the art galleries. I want to see the city. I want to find things. Yeah. You know, having great food and wonderful drinks and some chill out times, amazing. But I need that psychological enrichment on whatever level, because there's little things that just make me go, right. Ooh.
You know, walking through the columns of Karnak, diving in a cenote in the Yucatan Peninsula, walking the back alleys of Dubrovnik in Croatia. You know, those are things that I've done. Mm. And, you know, every time I've done that, it makes me think that I'm a little tiny part of the world. Mm. But then the other side of that is it makes me think human beings like me have done this.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about people that did it last week, last year, even in my lifetime, thousands of years ago. Mm. So what else is out there?
Yeah.
You know, what else is, you know, underneath the rock, you know, in Saqqara that we don't know about? You know, what, you know, if you follow Graham Hancock, you know, what is the next great discovery that points to maybe a highly advanced civilization, you know, that predates, you know, our historical records. And you always have to wonder if that next great discovery is around the corner, talking about, you know, that kind of stuff. I remember my minor's in anthropology and I was given had to write a paper and present it to the class in my archaeology class. And I actually quoted Heinrich von Däniken. And the professor told me to sit down, you know, and be quiet. But I knew the professor. I'd been on digs with him. So, you know, he and I knew each other rather well. And he knew I was just messing with him. But, you know, when I drew a picture of the pyramid with a flying saucer and a rope, he's like, just Trey, just sit down. You get credit. You get credit for this. Just sit down. Dr. Steinen, forgive me, you know. Yeah.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
So, this portal, Trey, now forgive me if I'm wrong. Is this the footage that you shared on the show Alien Encounters, which I think was the last time anybody might have seen you in the UK? Obviously, I think we're a few months behind. Yeah. But I really like that show because I like Mitch and I like Chrissy. I think they're two really intelligent, switched on people coming at it from different ways, because obviously Mitch is a big folklorist and Chrissy is obviously a leading light in ufology. You know, obviously she's based in Canada, but she's kind of drawn herself down into the US as well in regards to what's going on. Two very engaging, intelligent people I've got a lot of time for. Every time I've seen them, I've enjoyed listening to them on a variety of topics.
Right.
I have to be honest, I was surprised to see you on it, Trey, because not for no other reason was I knew who you were.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And I suspect they did, because they have to go, oh, what have you brought us, Mr. Hudson?
Yeah.
Because I would imagine those two would have, your reputation does precede you, Trey, in certain circles, and in a good way as well. You know, I'm not trying to damn you by fame praise. Because obviously I'd watched that whole series, and so when you popped up, I was like, oh, here's somebody I'm aware of. I'm really excited. I have to say, when I saw that, I couldn't believe what I was seeing, because
it
blew my mind. And because to be fair, they'd shown some very interesting things on that show. I think they had to have that kind of thing where we know what that is, and it's very explainable, I think, because you've got to have that balance. And you know, some people don't look at the sky as often as perhaps people like you or I do, Trey.
Right.
So I thought it was brilliant in the regards to the fact that, firstly, you were there. Firstly, you were prepared to show this.
Right.
And also let them sort of look at it, analyze it, take it away, and utilize the skill sets that they had behind the scenes to give some evaluation of it. And they were completely stumped.
They were stumped. It was kind of funny because, you know, their findings, and of course the three people that, and I know the three people that were their analysts. Mm-hmm. I know them personally. And it was kind of funny because when I found out, I called them up, said, hey, you know, thanks for, you know, looking at my video. And they said, yeah, you know, when it came across our desk, we knew that, you know, number one, what you videotaped is what you videotaped, but we gave it a good, you know, good running through anyway. But, you know, the thing was inconclusive. And so, you know, Chrissy, you know, when she slides a report over, she goes, you know, our expert said it, and it's inconclusive. And I said, okay, I'll agree with that. And the producer, Chrissy goes, hold on. The producer says, can you like react a little bit more? And I said, why would I? That's a reasonable, you know, that's reasonable. Nobody knows what this is.
Yeah.
So that's why in the TV series, when she says it's inconclusive, and I kind of go like that. That was, you know, me sexing it up a little bit.
Somebody off screen, but, you know, prodding you, Trey.
Yeah, it was like, you know, can you show a little reaction? And, you know, and like I said, that's a reasonable analysis.
Yeah.
But I went back and I started thinking about this, you know, when I was writing my second book, and I thought, okay, so you have people that have, you know, amazing experiences with something in the sky, and they can't figure out what it is. That's an unidentified flying object. And Mitch would say, and I can't do a Mitch voice, but he's like, congratulations, you know, you saw a UFO, you know, and people, oh, yay, you know.
Yes.
And then you go, oh, Trey, you know, it was inconclusive. And I'm like, wait, that's kind of the same thing, isn't it? Mm. Yeah, except this is on the ground. So I developed a term in my second book, and MUFON is actually looking at using this as an actual term, is a UTE, an unexplained terrestrial event.
Oh.
That is unexplained things that happen on the ground that you can't define using science and normal metrics. And I was going to have it, I was going to call it a unexplained terrestrial incident, but I thought it would sound really strange if somebody said, yeah, I went out in the woods with a bunch of strangers and I had the most amazing UTI, which means urinary tract infection. So I thought, that's scrap UTI. We'll go with event. Unexplained terrestrial event, not incident. So, yeah, you gotta have a sense
absolutely.
Of humor.
Well, I was going to say, otherwise you'd be getting a sponsorship from Tenor, I think, perhaps.
Yeah. But, you know, it was... But it was a very real, organic review of that footage.
Mm.
And everybody who has seen it, whether they have seen it, you know, in passing or have actually really dug down into it, finds it absolutely phenomenal because it defies explanation. And, you know, I don't know if your viewers have seen it. If you want to see it, film comes out on Sunday. It'll be in that film.
Mm-hmm.
It's also in Alien Encounters Factor Fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can find that on Discovery. But it's basically my team starts experiencing sightings of cubes or boxes, you know, in the meadow. And we're radioing back and forth. We're seeing these cubes and boxes. And we actually vector a team over into one of these, where one of these cubes or boxes was. And their heat signatures are completely obliterated off of our thermals.
Mm.
We can't see them. They're gone. And what makes it interesting is when they describe going into it, they go into it, they talk about it being very dark, cold, no sound. They went into it unencumbered.
Mm-hmm.
But yet when they stayed in about 90 seconds and they come back out, they run into branches and brambles and things that they had to kind of fight through to get back out. Mm. So once again, it's almost like there were two realities. There was a reality inside of the cube that was very pristine and, you know, nice without brambles and briars. Mm. But then as it dissipated, they came back into the reality of the environment that they were in, which was, you know, in the woods, which had branches and tree, briars and brambles and things like that. So, you know, it was really an amazing thing. And if you go and you read a book by Dr. Simeon Hines called Dark Matter Monsters, he talks about how quantum effects and the conservation or use of energy explains cold spots during incidents of high strangeness. Ghosts. We always talk about cold spots. And these boxes were actually cooler than the surrounding environment. Mm. So we went back at the same time of year and tried to recreate it during the daytime, where the ambient temperature between the individuals and the environment was closer.
Yeah.
So it should have been easier to obscure their signature, their heat signature, during the day, during this recreation. Mm. We were not able to do it. Mm. And that was something that was shown on the series, too, if you remember. Yes. The recreation, where we were not able to obscure their heat signature. Mm. So that was, that was just a very crazy, you know, incident. And I use that term portal, and that's a loaded term, you know, and I usually hate labels because they're very, very limiting. But a portal is merely a gateway or a threshold into something that's not here. That's not this.
Yes.
It's something else. So I think, you know, it's fair to use the term portal in that particular application. Now, it's interesting that it manifested itself in the form of a cube or a box. Mm. If we get in the Wayback Machine and we go way, 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 way back into the Old Testament, the Ark of the Covenant was a box.
Yep.
Yeah, that box contained Staff of Aaron, remains of the Ten Commandments, in a jar of manna. Mm. That box was a means to communicate with a ultra-terrestrial or a paradimensional.
Yes.
That they called Yahweh. Mm. When they built a permanent presence, when they were going through the desert, the tabernacle, once again, was a tent that was box-like.
Yep.
When the temple was built in Jerusalem, the Holy or Holies or Sanctum Sanctorium, where the Ark of the Covenant was kept, was a box or a cube. Mm. The New Testament in the book of Revelation talks about the New Jerusalem coming down from the sky.
As a cube.
It is a cube, 1,400 miles square. Mm. You go to Mecca, there's a thing there called the Kaaba.
Yes.
Which is a black cube. The corner of the Kaaba contains the remnants of a meteorite.
Yes, it does.
Which was considered sacred by the polytheists that were there before Islam. Mm. But even in Islam, it's considered special to try to touch the black cube or the meteorite as you work your way around the black cube.
Yeah.
We go fast forward. The Carl Higdon case in Wyoming is a famous UFO case where the UFO manifested itself as a cube. Mm. The alchemist had something called the prima materia.
Yes.
Which is what they believed all matter was made of. That was represented in alchemical text as a cube, the perfect basic form.
Yeah.
We go to the meadow. It's transformative. It almost looks like it's another reality. It manifests itself as a black cube. Mm. Katie Page in the Clearview Ranch case, some of the things they encountered at the ranch were cubes or boxes.
Yeah.
And I've been to the ranch and been to some of the places where these cubes or boxes were there in Colorado. Mm. So there's something about cubes or boxes being a very primal, sacred shape. Now, do I know why that is? I have no idea why the cube or box is a representation of this multidimensional or extra-dimensional event manifests itself as a cube or a box. But it's very interesting. You look back in history, back in our folklore, that these multidimensional or transdimensional events, transdimensional concepts are represented by a cube, figuratively and allegorically.
I suppose you could say that a cube is a perfect design for this because you can see it, but you can't see all sides of it.
Right. Well, and, you know, a cube is a perfect three-dimensional object in our dimension, you know, in our dimensional understanding, our Euclidean universe, it has height, it has depth, and it has width.
Mm.
And that's it. That's all it has.
Mm.
And they're, you know, they're finite. That's very defined metrics with, you know, link where you wouldn't with a sphere because it's, you know, it's round.
Yes.
So, you know, is the fact that it's a cube, is the fact that the cube motif goes all the way back, you know, probably to prehistory.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a way that this non-human intelligence is trying to communicate with us that we're extra dimensional and we're going to manifest ourselves or our equipment or our consciousness or our data, whatever it is, into your Euclidean universe as a cube?
Mm.
So perhaps you can better understand it. Now that's a hypothesis. I have no idea what it means.
Yes.
But it could be it.
Mm. I suppose the obvious question is, Trey, how did they feel after this experience? Because, you know, as I remember, one of the, as you say, when they went into it and they were discussing these sort of emotional and physical responses to what was happening, as soon as you started discussing this, and when I've heard you speak about it before, the first thing I jumped to in my head was these, as Keel called them, these spheres of fear that seemed to appear all around Point Pleasant. You could basically walk in.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you would feel emotionally drained and terrified. But you if you walked through it, you would pop out of it like you were walking through a bubble of fear. And so he would repeat it. And every time he did it, it got easier because he understood what was happening. But it's very similar that there must have been some kind of emotional and physical response to what happened to them, even on a what have I just experienced level.
You know, it was not a fearful or traumatic experience. For the individuals, it was more a sense of wonder and awe. You know, we had gone out there, we'd experienced high strangeness in that location before, and now we're experiencing it again. And in true Meadow fashion, it's changing, it's evolving. It's not what we experienced previously. And it was a sense of, what did we just experience? What did we just see? What did we just, you know, live through? It was the amazement, it was the wonder of the moment that really made the impression. And it was so impressive, and it made such a mark on our team members that when we were able to get back, we downloaded the data from the various SD cards from people's thermals. We put it on a thumb drive and had one of the members get on his motorcycle and drive 3 hours back to his house. And he arrived in the middle of the night, and the first thing he did was wrap that thumb drive up in foil to create a Faraday cage and put it inside of a metal safe.
Mm.
Because we were so fearful that data would be erased.
Yeah.
And luckily, there were so many copies made of it, it's now become the famous cube or portal video that, you know, people, you know, all over the world have seen.
Mm. I suppose this is the aspect of it, because when it comes to areas of high strangeness, and like you say, it would be easy to try and leap to some kind of explanation, but I think that's what perplexes people, and fair play to you for not trying to explain it away, because I think you end up boxing yourself in, ironically, very quickly, Trey, in that kind of situation, because it just seems that every time you think, well, as with anything, every time you seem to think you've got a grip on what's happening, it kind of pulls the rug from under you and goes, ha ha, now then, let's see what you think to this.
Yeah, that's absolutely what this place will do. is in the film I talk about, while I'm briefing Merkel and his team, that this place will lead you into a false sense of security where you think you have it figured out, and then it will throw you something from left field. And I'm not going to give the film away, but that's what happened to them. Every time we think we have it figured out, or we kind of have pinpointed the phenomena we're going to expect, we get something else. It's actually evolved into being physically touched now. You know, people have been physically touched by something. So it's almost like maybe the other is as curious about us as we are of them, and it's become more comfortable with us.
Mm.
You know, that's maybe. And so we always wonder every time we go out there, what's next? You know, what's going to happen next? And it is revealing itself in just some insane ways.
Mm.
You know, and I'm not going to give it away, but you know, if folks watch the film, hang around for the after party for the Q&A, because there's just some crazy stuff.
Mm.
And, you know, after going through this for 9 years, I still, it'll manifest in a way that'll make my jaw drop. you know, which is, that's saying a lot.
Absolutely. Well, I suppose before I let you go, Trey, we need to talk about, obviously, you've got your latest book as in conjunction with this film release. So for anybody who's not aware of it or what's going on, let's start with the book first before we promote the film. So, yes, tell us all about your book and where people can find out what's going on with it.
Yeah, the first book is called The Meadow Project: Explorations into the South Skinwalker Ranch. And if you just Google Trey Hudson or Amazon, go into their search bar, type Trey Hudson, it'll come up. My second book is called Return to the Meadow. You can also find it. It basically takes our explorations from 2020 up to the present.
Mm-hmm.
And the really cool thing about that is I talked about hypnotic regression is in that book, and the section called Revelations is I had the transcripts from Bob's hypnotic regression and also the transcripts from Kristen's hypnotic regression, where once we punched through the veil of her memory, she started having accounts of something very akin to abductions, you know, John Mack, you know, Bud Hopkins kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are some really amazing things that happened, you know, happened there. So that's in the second book. The film is coming out on Sunday. The premiere is the 27th. If you go to Google and you type, dang, my mind just went completely blank, Movement, which is the name of the company that's doing the premiere, Movement, comma, The Meadow Project, it'll drop you to the ticket page where you can buy tickets to the premiere. The after party Q&A is also there. And once we get the premiere out, then we're going to start working on put data out there for distribution. You can find me on Facebook at Trey Hudson Author. Also my my personal page, which is TreyHudsonResearch.com. Or you can go behind the alley in the local liquor store, then you'll find me asleep in my own vomit under a cardboard box. No, I made that up.
I'm glad you've left those days behind you, Trey.
Yeah. Aren't we all? Like I said, you have to have a sense of humor with this stuff.
It's, absolutely.
It can get kind of grim if you don't.
Well, exactly. And I think sometimes you've got to take this with a lighter touch, I think, sometimes, because history is full of people that fell down rabbit holes and sent themselves mad, essentially, Trey. And I think you've got to have a bit of self-deprecation and a bit of humor in regards to when you're dealing with strange phenomena. Otherwise, it will send you round the twist.
Yeah, it will.
Mm. Well, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure to spend some time in your company for the first time. I hope it's not the last time I speak with you. It's been fascinating. It's been far funnier than I expected. And it's given me a deeper understanding and a richness to the work you and your team are doing. And I just want to say thank you again for your time and fitting me in, sir.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry that, you know, it's my schedule so busy. I always think I'm going to have some time, but I never do. But yeah, absolutely. I would love to come back. It's been an honor to be here. And I can't think of a better way to spend an afternoon than with you.
Thank you, Trey. You take care.
Okay, you too. Take care. Cheers.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.